I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. 100 years ago, most immigrants to the U.S. were processed at Ellis Island in New York Bay within sight of the Statue of Liberty. In the 60 years it was open, an estimated 12 million people were evaluated and given entry to the country. The U.S. Public Health Service administered medical and psychological tests to weed out those who were considered undesirable. Our guest Adam Cohen writes about some of those tests in the May edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. He was a guest on Radio Times last year to discuss his book, Imbecile, about the impact of the now discredited eugenics movement that tried to control breeding in order to improve the human race and influenced immigration policy. Adam Cohen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back with you.
Your piece begins with a description of a puzzle. It was called the Feature Profile Test. Describe the puzzle to our listeners.
Sure. It's a little wooden puzzle, very simple looking. It almost looks like a flattened out Mr. Potato Head. It's got a nose, a mouth, some ears. And the point of the puzzle is to ask the immigrant to try to assemble it so it looks like an actual human face.
Is it hard to do?
Not very hard to do for us, probably, but, you know, could be hard for someone who has maybe landed at Ellis Island after 2 weeks in steerage. Maybe they're seasick and, you know, physically sick. And also maybe they've never done a test before. You know, they might not even understand the concept of testing. Who knows where they're coming from? So I would say for some people, it probably was quite hard.
What were some of the other tests that immigrants coming to Ellis Island had to take?
Well, you know, at the beginning, there was much more, you know, the early IQ tests were much more written and more like what we think of as an IQ test today. Then there was a guy came along named Howard Knox, who was the doctor at Ellis Island, and he was the one who introduced puzzle tests of this kind. And the idea was to try to create tests which the immigrants could actually, you know, work on in their own language or with no language at all. So it was more puzzles like this. Over time. And, you know, even though we think of this as being, you know, in some ways a pretty odd and unfortunate idea that they were doing intelligence testing in this way, in some ways, puzzles like this face test were a progressive reform, because the idea was at least to try to create puzzles that immigrants who didn't know English, who were not literate, maybe could solve.
Well, I'm thinking if there's a language barrier, which I'm sure there was in many cases, or even translation or cultural barriers, taking a traditional IQ test would have been pretty difficult for someone coming to this country through Ellis Island.
Absolutely right. But the thing is that, you know, we were so crazy about IQ testing in the early part of the 20th century. There was such a mania for them that people kind of accepted the results at face value. So there was a guy named Goddard who did a famous round of testing at Ellis Island in 1910 of immigrants. And he reported that up to 40% to 50% of Jewish immigrants arriving at Ellis Island were feeble-minded based on the results of his test. And people actually accepted that. It's hard to believe because, you know, again, these are people who have come through some real physical trauma of getting here. They may not be familiar with testing. Their language skills may not be very good. The translations may not be very good. But generally, people were willing to accept that and say, wow, we've got a problem because 40% to 50% of the immigrants arriving are feeble-minded.
And I assume if we're talking about Ellis Island, we're talking about people from Europe or Eastern Europe or certainly that part of the world.
That's right. And, you know, at the time, there was a eugenics movement that was very strong at the beginning of the 20th century that said that we needed to protect our gene pool. And it really was believed that people coming from those countries were genetically inferior and that in terms of intelligence and mental health and feeble-mindedness, as they called it. So they were really seen as a threat. And people testified in Congress about the fact that people from these countries, from Italy, from Eastern Europe, Eastern European Jews, were actually genetically intellectually inferior. So that was the fear that people were sort of working against.
What was that based on, this whole eugenics movement?
Yeah, so it started in England. Half-cousin of Charles Darwin named Francis Galton said that, you know, now that we've learned from Darwin about evolution, why doesn't the human race try to take its own future into its own hands by deciding who should reproduce and who shouldn't? So that became the eugenics movement, the idea that we'll stop the, quote, wrong people from reproducing and we'll encourage the, quote, right people to reproduce more. So in America, that became an idea that said that we should try to stop the, quote, feeble-minded from reproducing in America, and that led to actually eugenic sterilization laws in more than half the states, but it also led to an immigration policy that was very much focused on keeping the, quote, wrong people out, and the wrong people included people who, you know, couldn't do puzzle tests like this.
You've used the word feeble-minded several times. What was there a working definition 100 years ago for that category?
There was, and you know, and they actually had categories. Idiot was the lowest category of feeble-minded. Then imbecile was the middle category, and moron was the highest category. All still feeble-minded, and it had to do with not doing well on intelligence tests. But then they threw in other kinds of people under this catch-all phrase as well. So women who were considered to be overly interested in sex, people who got into trouble with the law, might also be designated feeble-minded. But this was this idea that there were some people who genetically their intellectual ability were such that they were really a threat to our country. We had to stop them.
Was it also used against people for their political beliefs?
Well, it could be, but, you know, that was another thing that they actually did test for at Ellis Island. They were testing for, as you mentioned, physical and mental illness. They were also looking at whether people had financial support. They were also asking people about radical politics and things like that. So that might come under the radical politics rubric, but these were all the things they were trying to weed immigrants out for. They were all considered, you know, a threat to the country.
There was the Immigration Act of 1924. Was this based on both the sort of what was happening at Ellis Island, but also this fear of the other?
Absolutely. And it was actually based on eugenics as well. There was testimony from a leading scientist named Harry Laughlin to Congress, who was actually designated the expert eugenic agent for Congress, who said that people coming from these countries were bringing down the American gene pool. They were less intelligent. They had more mental problems. And that contributed to Congress's decision to vote in 1924, as you mentioned, for the Immigration Act of 1924, which sharply reduced immigration from Italy, from Eastern Europe, particularly Eastern European Jews, and from Asia, because those were deemed to be people that were bringing our country down.
How long was that in effect?
Well, really, through 1965, it's the major law that affected most of 20th century immigration, and it really cut down immigration sharply. We were, before it was passed, those were some of the highest immigration years in American history. Over a million people came in years like 1907, 1908, and then after 1924, cut down sharply, and it also changed the sort of people who were coming in. Many fewer Italians, Eastern European Jews, Asians, and more people from England and Germany, because those were deemed to be the better Nordic stock that we thought we wanted more of.
Something like 12 million people went through Ellis Island. I visited Ellis Island. I had family on my husband's side that came through Ellis Island, and it's an extraordinary place. I just have to say, even just standing in the facility there, and what you see in New York Harbor, what you see the Statue of Liberty, you see New York. Obviously, it's in many ways an inspiring place.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, you know, 12 million people passed through. So many of us can trace our own grandparents and great-grandparents as having come through there. So it was, in many ways, a great beacon of opportunity and freedom. And I know that, you know, in families like mine, you know, people thought this was a wonderful opportunity to create a new life, and it was. But there were also about 2% of the people who landed there were turned back for various reasons. And it could be for a reason as simple as not being able to put the pieces of a face puzzle together.
It was also called the Island of Tears, and I guess for those people that were turned away.
Absolutely. You know, people arriving there were, in many cases, quite confused. They didn't know the rules. They didn't know what they had to prove. They were being questioned about, you know, their politics. They were being questioned about their financial support. And they knew that a certain number of people would be sent back. And I'm sure there was a certain amount of randomness, and there wasn't a lot of due process. So, yeah, it was a time for many people of great hope and opportunity, but also fear and confusion. And, yes, tears when, you know, families were literally broken up when one sick member of the family might be sent back to Europe.
Like a mother or a father, somebody like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, they didn't have the protections we have now of, like, let's go to court and get a temporary restraining order. You know, there was a lot of arbitrary decision-making by people in positions of authority. And, you know, the vast number of people did get through and went on to, you know, better lives as Americans. But there were the ones who were turned back for, you know, sometimes arbitrary reasons.
But do you think a country should have some kind of evaluation for people coming in? Maybe not a puzzle test or some of these designations like imbecile, but some kind of evaluation for people coming into the country?
Well, I mean, certainly at a minimal level, you might want to make sure that people aren't coming in with very serious communicable diseases and so forth. So I don't think that, you know, many people are saying that the border should be completely open or that there should be no examination at the border. But what you see so often is, as you mentioned, the fear of the other, the fear that the immigrant is different from us, is a threat to us. And then when you combine that with this sort of toxicity of the eugenics movement of the early 20th century, you got these crazy tests where people were saying, we believe that you're from bad genetic stock, that your genes will bring down our gene pool, and we've developed a little test that will determine if you are that kind of threat. When you're talking about immigrants in that way, it's, you know, quite offensive and, you know, really something that we should be ashamed about.
Do we still have an eugenics, if not movement, at least eugenics beliefs?
Well, you do hear it popping up, right? There was a congressman from Iowa a month or two ago who talked about, you know, the civilization we want to build and, you know, the wrong kind of babies and so forth. And yes, you do see people talking about immigrants in a way that, you know, they may not be talking in Francis Galton's actual language about the gene pool and the genetic threat. But absolutely, I think there is a current in the current immigration debate of fear that the people coming are not, you know, as worthy of being here as those who are already here.
It's so interesting when we think about our own history. We do pride ourselves. We are a nation of immigrants. We often say that very proudly. And yet we have a history of not being particularly welcoming to new immigrants. How do you understand that?
That's absolutely right. Those are the two sides of the coin. And we are a history of immigrants, and we have admitted so many immigrants and continue to do that to this day. But we've also have a long history of nativism, of fear of the immigrant, of demonizing the immigrant, and yes, of passing laws that are actually designed to keep immigrants out because we think they're inferior. So, you know, that's the complexity of America, you know, some of our greatest ideals, but also not always quite living up to them.
Do you think we ever will live up to them or live up to being more welcoming for new immigrants?
You know, I do think we are admitting many immigrants today. And, you know, I think we are still the biggest host of refugees in the world right now. So, I mean, you know, there's always a wonderful welcomeness, but we see the backlash as well. So it's, I think, a continuing struggle to sort of keep us on the right path.
And I assume you've been to Ellis Island?
I have, yes, and my own, you know, my own great grandparents came through, and it's very moving to me, and I can try to put myself in the mindset of those who came through, and I think it's very difficult to think about growing up in some small village in, you know, in rural Eastern Europe, and then arriving in this, you know, amazing huge hall, and hearing all the different languages, and seeing all the authority figures in jackets and all that. I know in my family, though, the feeling about immigration was very positive. That, you know, America was truly a land of opportunity. And I know they were grateful from the moment they got here and grateful their whole lives for being here.
Adam Cohen, thanks for joining us on Radio Times. Thanks a lot.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we've been talking about an article that he wrote in the May edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. And he was a guest on Radio Times last year, a book called Imbeciles. He's a former member of the New York Times editorial board, and he's a lawyer. Laura Meckler, waiting in the wings. She writes about immigration and demographics for the Wall Street Journal, carrying on our conversation about immigration today on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While President Trump has not gotten the billions of dollars to build a border wall and his Muslim travel ban and sanctuary city policy are tied up in the courts, he has been able to use his bully pulpit and executive orders to make changes in the country's immigration laws. There's been a crackdown on undocumented immigrants and a fall off of people trying to get into the country through Mexico. We asked Laura Meckler, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, who covers immigration and demographics, to talk about what the president has done and its effect on immigrant communities. And Laura, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
And to our listeners, let me open up the lines here. Our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can call or text us. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you think about our immigration policy and what the president either has or hasn't done. I'm thinking about, Laura, the various campaign promises that the president made, but it seems that has collided with the budget, with Congress, with Washington, D.C.? Where do things stand?
Well, you're right. There's been quite a bit that he's tried to do that he hasn't been able to do. There are, you know, various checks and balances in our government, and he has run into them in terms of restricting travel from those majority Muslim nations. He that was stopped by the courts and is still under review. In terms of his border wall, he tried to get the funding through a funding bill that was moving through Congress, and it didn't come through. That said, I do think that he is having an impact in some other ways, and that are pretty profound in terms of immigration policy in this country. Notably, the deportation policy. It's much easier. They're deporting a lot more people, and the standards are a lot different than they were under the Obama administration.
There has been money. And are there more ICE officials, people who are removing undocumented immigrants from the country?
No, they've requested more ICE officers, money for 10,000 more ICE officers, and, you know, they may get some of that. They, you know, theoretically could get all, although I doubt it. I think it's more along the lines of what are the guidelines that the existing ICE officers are using. It used to be that you really had to fall into a group of what were called priorities. You had to be a pretty serious criminal conviction in order to be, or a recent border crosser in order to be deported. And now they do have priorities, but they're a lot looser. It's anybody convicted of or charged with any crime, anybody who has a removal order on the books. Some of these removal orders are very old, and anyone who ICE officials just kind of happens to encounter in their everyday work. And that's so a lot of people can kind of get swept up in that. So there is a lot. There are a lot of people who are still being affected.
There was a roundup of immigrants in the last week or so by ICE officials, I think almost 700 immigrants, and they found that something like half of them had no criminal convictions. They were more like traffic violations or traffic offenses, including things like drunk driving, which, of course, is a dangerous offense. But is that what you're talking about, Laura?
Yeah, I am talking about that. And also it's a situation where if they are still targeting criminals, but, you know, they go and they go to arrest somebody who does have a serious criminal conviction, let's say, and they walk into a house and there are three other people sitting there with them. They may ask them for their papers, and if it turns out that they're undocumented, then they may be deported as well. So that's how you end up getting non-criminals. It's not so much that they're just randomly plucking people off the street. It's that if they encounter them while they're doing their operations, then they will go ahead and process them if they are, you know, not here without authorization.
How does this compare to the Obama administration? I realize we're only a couple of months into the Trump administration, but President Obama was called by some the deporter in chief. How does President Trump compare, at least so far?
Well, we don't have numbers for Trump's deportation numbers, but I think there's no doubt that we're certainly from the interior, we're going to see higher numbers of people being removed from the interior of the country versus people who are technically deported right when they cross the border. You know, I always thought that those numbers about Obama were a bit overstated. It was a political campaign to try to get Obama to ease up and to try to get him to take executive action, which, of course, ultimately he did, to try to protect people living in the country illegally. Obama's numbers hit 400,000 in a year, and that was a record. But a lot of those deportations were, again, people caught at the border and then put into formal deportation proceedings, and then therefore they were counted in the figures. So we'll have to see how the Trump numbers happen at the end of the day. But I think there's no doubt that even before Obama eased up his policy, what we're seeing now is a more aggressive deportation approach than what Obama had at any point during his presidency, and certainly at the end of his presidency.
Are we seeing the same number of border crossings? I'm thinking, of course, of that border, the Mexican-U.S. border. Are we seeing more or less people coming across? And certainly the President Trump and candidate Trump's rhetoric was not welcoming at all. Has that kept people away?
Well, actually, the numbers have dropped dramatically. They're way lower than they had been in terms of apprehensions at the on the Southwest border. So you know, that brings up two points. They're sort of a mixed bag for the Trump administration. On one hand, you say, okay, this tough talk, maybe it's working. It's deterring people from coming. On the other hand, you'd say, well, okay, if deportations are at such a low level, lower than they've been in years, you know, why do we need to spend billions of dollars on a border wall or even billions of dollars on border security at all? I mean, it seems to be, you know, the flow is so low. So I think that that's a you know, that's a question that Congress is wrestling with right now.
Do you think that's why there wasn't money in this budget plan for the border wall, which I think is as much as something like $21 billion, assuming it's the wall that candidate Trump was promising?
Well, yeah, the estimates of how much this thing would ultimately cost are all over the board. There was an internal estimate by the Homeland Security Department of that put it at $21 billion. But, you know, there are other estimates out there, too. Regardless, it's a huge amount. The White House was asking for essentially a first a down payment on that, a first tranche of money towards the border wall. And I think the reason that Congress said no is a couple reasons. Number one, there's very little support in Congress for this plan. And particularly, there's scant support of members of Congress who represent the border. We did a story for the Journal surveying every member who represents the border. So that was 8 senators and 9 members of the House. And none of them were willing to say or wanted to say that they supported the supplemental funding. That includes even Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, who was taking a hard line on immigration. He was not coming out in favor of this funding. So you have to look at it and say, why is that? And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that building a wall along the border is a lot easier said than done. There are a lot of complicating factors to it. A lot of people think it's not the best or the smartest border security, that we're much better off with technology than we are with actual bricks and mortar in certain places. That they say what most Homeland Security experts will tell you is that barriers, fences, or walls have a place in certain, are effective in certain parts of the border, particularly urban areas where it's very easy to go back and forth and there are big populations, and if you cross over, you can easily disappear. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere, basically, like open land, you know, why do you need a wall there or rugged terrain, you know, where it's already difficult to cross? So I think that those are some of the reasons why you've seen a lack of support. And then, of course, the other reason is that the Republicans were in no interest, had no interest in having a showdown fight over this with the Democrats who were opposed. They didn't want to shut the government down over this, and they didn't think that would go well for them. So that was the other reason why it didn't happen.
And of course, Mexico was supposed to pay for the wall in the first place.
Right. Well, now, of course, President Trump is saying that Mexico will ultimately pay. They're going to reimburse us for the cost of it, which, you know, you cannot. It's very hard to find. There are a few members of Congress who believe that, but very few do. I mean, Mexico has made it clear in no uncertain terms that they have no intention of paying for this wall.
That's Laura Meckler. She's a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She covers immigration and demographics. And we asked her to get us up to speed on what's been happening in Washington, talking a bit about what candidate Trump promised his voters, and certainly talking about how things are panning out so far, just a couple of months into office. And again, you can join our conversation. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And what are you looking for when it comes to immigration policy? Laura, there's also this new office for victims of violent undocumented immigrants, the Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement, which I think is the word VOICE, part of ICE. What is this program supposed to do?
Well, this is another promise from President Trump when he was a candidate, and it's something that they have followed through with. What this is supposed to do is support people who have been victims or whose family members have been victims of crime committed by illegal immigrants. So, you know, in some ways, this is actually just sort of a repackaging of services that were already available. There are community officers who are and victim assistance coordinators. I forget what their exact titles are, but people who work with members of the public already who work for ICE. Mm-hmm. And what this does is essentially organize those services in a new way. They're not hiring any new people. There's a hotline that already existed, an 800 number people can call, and now they've added another branded voice, voice-branded 800 number that you can call to get connected to somebody who can help you figure out what kind of services are available. What they say that this will do is, you know, there are services locally available to support crime victims to find out what's happening with the person's case as it moves through the courts. This is supposed to let people know what's happening with their deportation as it moves through deportation proceedings. That's the stated purpose of this, and to generally support it. The unstated purpose, I think, is to highlight, you know, the damage that some illegal immigrants have done. I mean, I think that what you've seen from a lot of people who are pro-immigration is that they lift up the stories of immigrants who make contributions to this country. And what I think they're doing is lifting up the stories of immigrants who cause damage and pain and suffering in this country. So I think it's a bit of a political message as well. So. On both sides, frankly. I mean, there are, you know, obviously illegal immigrants are great people and not great people, just like the rest of us.
But I wonder whether comparing undocumented immigrants to native-born Americans, which group commits more crimes?
Right. Yes. Well, the studies are clear that they do, native-born Americans are more likely to commit crime than undocumented immigrants are. You know, that said, what they would say to that is that, well, none of these crimes should happen because these are people who shouldn't be here in the first place.
Just obviously, if you're here undocumented, you're here illegally, and that's a crime, right?
Well, you know, it's not exactly, it's weird. It's not a crime per se that you could go to jail for just simply being here illegally. You are, however, not, you do not have a lawful presence and you do not have a right to stay. So it gets a little bit technical. So it's not exactly a crime, but you don't have authorization.
I have a text from a listener here, Lars, who says, I was presented with a form from Homeland Security at work yesterday along with all of my coworkers. I'm not sure what kind of work this person does. It was an employment eligibility form asking if I was a citizen or an alien. Mr. Trump is targeting everyone. Can you speak to that at all, Lars?
I think that that's a form that's long been required. I'm not an expert on this, but I know that, for instance, you know, years ago when we hired someone to take care of our kids, we had to have the person fill out that form. So I don't think that that's anything new.
I'm interested about the...
I could be wrong. I don't want to put myself as an expert on that, but sure. I believe that that's a form that everybody has long had to fill out.
What's been the impact of President Trump on the flow of documented immigrants, people who were coming here, you know, not coming across the border in the middle of the night, but coming here through legal channels?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's been a specific impact in the sense that, I mean, in terms of, so I don't know if you're talking about tourism, people who are just coming to visit.
Or coming to work or having a H-1B visa, people like
right.
that.
So the number of H-1B visas is set every year at 85,000. There's huge demand for those visas, and the demand far outstrips the supply. They award them by lottery. The numbers were a little bit down this year in terms of the people who were applying for these visas. Still, there were something like 200,000 applicants for 85,000 spots, so there was still way more demand than supply. That said, that was down a little bit, and there has been a lot of discussion, and the Trump administration has moved to signal that it wants to make changes in how we allocate those H-1B visas, whether, you know, how many of, there's a lot of criticism of some particular companies and how they use it, mostly outsourcing companies, which some of which are based in India, and what they do is essentially, it's like when your company doesn't want to do its own IT work, it will hire one of these outsourcing companies to do it for you. And a lot of these companies have a lot of H-1B workers, so foreign workers in the U.S. working for them. And the question is, are they really trying hard enough to get Americans? Are they paying enough versus, let's say, a tech firm like a Google or a Microsoft, which also uses H-1B visas but pay much higher salaries? So there's debate in that realm of should that be changed, so how these visas are awarded. So that's a whole other piece of immigration policy up for debate right now.
We're going to be talking with our third guest about a chicken processing plant and the treatment, or I have to say mistreatment, of a lot of the unskilled or low-skilled workers who work there. What is the law as it stands today for businesses who hire foreign workers? Laura?
Well, they need to, I mean, the law is that they need to be here lawfully. I mean, and there are different types of programs besides H-1B is for high-skilled workers. There are also other programs for lower-skilled workers. You know, obviously not everybody, there are lots of people working who are working without authorization, right. but they are supposed to be here on one of the visa programs that's available.
Well, I'm thinking people that pick crops or work in meat processing plants and just how difficult that work is, but also how these employers or these companies seem to get around the law.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the question is, are they really checking carefully when they hire people? I think that what they would tell you, and your next guest can probably talk about this in more detail, is that they can't find Americans who want to do this work. Now, what sort of the immigration restrictionists would say is, well, pay more. And if that means we all have to pay more for vegetables and meat, then that's the way it goes. But they would say they can't find Americans who want to do that work, and that's how it ends up happening. One of the sort of the holy grail for people who oppose increased immigration in this country is to pass a program called E-Verify, which would require every employer to run the names of new employees through a federal database to ensure that they're here legally. That is a voluntary program right now, and the companies that are more likely to be using undocumented workers are also less likely to be using the E-Verify program, obviously.
Well, Laura, we're going to leave it at that. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Laura Meckler, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She covers immigration and demographics. We've been talking about President Trump's immigration policies and some of his executive orders as well. And yes, we will be talking about a series of chicken processing plants and what happens there. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about immigration policy today, and now we want to focus on immigrants, many of them undocumented, who have been hired and fired by Case Farms. That's a chicken processing company with plants in Ohio and North Carolina. Our guest, Michael Graybell, wrote about the dangerous working conditions and treatment of the workers in an article in ProPublica and The New Yorker. The story is titled Sold for Parts, and it raises some troubling questions about how immigration laws are being violated and then used against workers who protest working conditions. Michael Graybell, again, reporter for ProPublica, covers the economy, labor, immigration, and trade. And Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with Case Farms. You toured the facility. You have some vivid descriptions of what it is like to work inside this processing plant. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Yeah, and just to begin, too, many of the listeners probably haven't heard of Case Farms, but it is a major supplier for fast food restaurants like KFC, Popeyes, and Taco Bell. Boar's Head uses it to make deli meat. And the U.S. government spends millions of dollars every year for the federal school lunch program. I went inside two of their chicken plants in Ohio. It is a very hard work. It's cold inside the chicken. The factory has to be kept at 45 degrees to prevent bacterial growth. It's very wet inside. The floors are slippery. And when the workers work on this cutting line, or what's known as a deboning line, where they remove the breasts, the wings, the chicken tenders from the chicken, it is essentially an assembly line, and the workers tell me they have to cut about 45 chickens per minute. And they do that, for 8 hours a day, which leads to a lot of pain in the arms and hands, leads to more severe injuries like amputations. And one that I wrote about, a worker who is working for a sanitation contractor for Case Farms, actually fell into a machine that turned on and literally ripped off his leg.
And I mean, I have to say, I read the article and it was just chilling in the various descriptions you have of what it's like at these processing plants. You also say that chicken processing plants are among the most dangerous places to work, and that OSHA, this was a little while ago, called Case Farms an outrageously, and I'm quoting here, outrageously dangerous place to work. The question being, why is it still open?
So OSHA has very limited authority to shut down a workplace because of safety issues. It really has to be an immediate threat, like the plant is about to explode. If they find that a company like Case Farms, what they have said is a repeat violator and has been ignoring safety laws for 25 years, according to OSHA, they still don't have the authority to shut it down. All they can do is fine and go through what can be a very lengthy appeals process. Case Farms has been fined more than $2 million now in the past few years, and all of those are under contest and will be several years, unless they reach a settlement, will be several years before there is a hearing on whether they have to pay.
You mentioned the young man that you profiled, Osiel Lopez Perez, the young man who lost his leg. He was just 17 years old at the time. He had actually fled from Guatemala. He was seeking asylum in the United States. His mother had been killed by a gang. How did he end up in Canton, Ohio?
So Osiel left Guatemala, and he came to the U.S., and he was an unaccompanied minor. So under immigration law, right now, if there's a sponsor in the U.S., they're put into a shelter, and if there's a sponsor in the U.S., they go and live with the sponsor, in this case his uncle, until their hearing. OCL came to Canton. The reason his uncle was at Canton was that many Guatemalans had come to Canton and this part of Ohio to work at the chicken plants. About 25 years ago, a Case Farms Human Resources manager drove a van down to Florida, where many refugees from the Guatemalan Civil War had fled and were living, and convinced them to come with him to go work in the chicken plant in North Carolina that Case Farms also has. And eventually this pipeline from Guatemala spread throughout its plants, really from one particular town in Guatemala called Aguacatan, and that has formed the backbone of Case Farms' workforce ever since. And so OCL was following this very well-worn path of Guatemalans working at the chicken plant.
In fact, you quote a manager who's saying, "I don't want Mexicans, I want Mayans," meaning people, I guess, from Guatemala, being that because there was a civil war, there was no chance that they would go back to their home country.
Yeah, it's a very dangerous time for Mayans in Guatemala. It's called a civil war, but not in the sense that we think of a civil war. This was really a series of massacres committed by the Guatemalan military and several regimes that the U.S. supported with weapons and money and training. And while some refugees did receive asylum, a lot of them didn't, and a lot of people grew up without their parents in Guatemala and eventually followed relatives to the U.S. in the 90s and 2000s, and those don't fit an easy definition of what under immigration law of how they're supposed to be treated. So right now, Guatemalans make up the second largest group of undocumented immigrants, but a lot of human rights advocates or immigrant advocates say that they should be treated more as refugees, and the U.S. should come to terms with its role in creating the conditions right now in Guatemala that are causing people to flee.
You also described over the years that the conditions at some of these plants, these processing plants, and there were strikes, there were walkouts. Was there union involvement at all with the workers?
There was. So one thing that made this story unique to me and why I was so interested in exploring it is that we all know that immigrants have a lot of fear about speaking up at work because they're afraid that they'll inform the authorities. So in this case, the workers defied the stereotype, and several times over the course of Case Farms history, formed unions, had strikes of 200 people, which is almost unheard of in the labor movement today. And so these workers did this, but were met with immigration checks of their immigration status by the company. Shortly after these strikes, there were often the company would often investigate immigration status or do a paperwork check, and the leaders or hundreds of workers or dozens of workers would be subsequently fired because their paperwork was suddenly found to be bad.
But did the company know that they were hiring undocumented workers?
The company says it never knowingly hired undocumented workers or unauthorized workers, but I found several incidents over the years that would raise red flags. A lot of workers told me that they there was kind of an unspoken policy that they could return to work under a new ID if for some reason their paperwork came back bad or for some reason child support was being taken out because someone who was using that number had a case against them. And one worker told me that he had worked under at the Case Farms plant under four different names, and the supervisors all knew this. Now, aside from this just being human resources supervisors who are trying to be nice and accommodating, there were three different incidents over the course of Case Farms history where some sort of law enforcement activity caused scores of immigrants to flee the plant or to literally flee the plant or to not show up for work the next day. And that certainly would have caught the attention of top managers because if they don't have enough workers to fill a shift and meet production. But it doesn't appear that any sort of audit occurred at that point. It was only when the workers protested that the company sought to find to do some immigration checks.
You quote actually a Supreme Court decision, and this has to do with the conditions on some of these farms. And you quote Justice Stephen Breyer, and I'm quoting here, predicted that the court's decision would incentivize employers to hire undocumented workers with a wink and a nod, knowing that they can violate the labor laws at least once with impunity. This goes back to a 2002 Supreme Court decision. What was that decision about?
This case is called Hoffman Plastics, and basically it affirms that workers, whether they're authorized or not, do have rights to form a union to engage in complaining about conditions at a work site. But what it said, and what Stephen Breyer was dissenting about, it said that companies did not have the obligation to hire them back because they're unauthorized, and also did not have the obligation to pay them any back pay. So while workers could complain, there was really no recourse for them. And so that affected several cases involving Case Farms where the National Labor Relations Board said that Case Farms had illegally fired the workers for their union activity, but the workers couldn't be hired back and were left without any restitution for that. And so it allowed them to sort of get away without anything more than less than a slap of the wrist, just sort of putting up a poster saying we violated the law and we promised not to do it again.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Michael Graybell, and he's a reporter for ProPublica covering the economy, labor, immigration, and trade. We're talking about his recent article. It's titled Sold for Parts. It was published at ProPublica and in The New Yorker, and it's about this chicken processing plant called Case Farms. And again, to call or to join our conversation, you can call or text us. Our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael, you did try to talk to the owner, or the CEO of Case Farms. You were turned down, but you did talk to a vice president. What did they say?
So they said that they try to follow immigration law, that they do not mistreat their workers, basically defending the company on everything that I had found. But one thing that was surprising is that they claim that they didn't know. They seem to shift a lot of blame or responsibility onto mid-level managers, and that they hoped that those managers didn't do these things, but that if they did, it was wrong. And so that raises the question a bit about, should they have been watching closer, and how do they not know these things were happening at the company over such a long period of time?
And it seems that even as you described, the head of the company is a he's a micromanager, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, it's kind of a mix. I mean, so he's extremely focused. Everyone I spoke to said he's a numbers guy. He's extremely focused on detail. He can recite a number of how many chickens were processed per minute back in 1987. And he's a former president of Purdue. But at the same time, he seems, other people said, he's not he's not micromanaging the chicken business every single day. Mm-hmm. They try to let them. It's very decentralized, where they almost let the local managers run it as they will. Even to the point of, if you're working with some sort of recruiting company to find workers, not having that approved at a central level, allowing them to essentially do that out of the single office at the plant.
You describe the quote-unquote creative uses of immigration law. I mean, on the one hand, it seems there's a sort of looking the other way when it comes to hiring people. But then once someone gets hurt, like this young man, Ociel Lopez Perez, he lost his leg and the company got rid of him. But once there's trouble, then it seems the company uses the laws against the worker. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So the current immigration law is written that says companies cannot knowingly hire unauthorized workers. And it also says that companies do not have to be document experts, and they also must accept any ID that reasonably appears to be genuine. So that creates a lot of wiggle room where it makes it extremely hard for the government to go after companies. At the same time, when the immigration law was passed, there were a lot of concessions that were, this is 1986, there were a lot of concessions that were made to get the business community support. So fines were fairly low, and or the penalties were fairly low, and since then there's been very weak enforcement of this. Now, at the same time, that law created this I-9 form that we all are familiar with that we fill out every time we go for a job,
right,
and we must swear under penalty of perjury that we are authorized to work in the U.S. Now, that has become a tool for employers to retaliate against workers because it's essentially a very strong piece of evidence that you have lied about your status if the company finds out. So on one hand, it's hard to go after employers, but it's easy for companies to go after workers, and that creates this this retaliation.
Let me play someone who called into our comment line.
My name's Pete, and I use H-2A visa workers for my agricultural business, and the agency that I use asked me to support Donald Trump because he was in support of the visa system, as opposed to, you know, having workers work undocumented on farms. And it's an arduous process, and it seems to me that rather than spending $21 billion on a wall, they spent $21 billion making the visa system a little bit more workable.
And we would not need the wall, is how we end it. Pete, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Michael, let me just put something else to you, and this is how you end your piece, which is, over time, Amish worked at Case Farms. Then we had people from Guatemala. There were Burmese refugees. There were Nepalese. You write about prisoners. And then looking into the future, it will be automation. Is that progress, do you think?
I don't know if it's so much as progress as a continuation of what we've seen in the U.S. labor market. Just like Laura from the Wall Street Journal, the last speaker, was saying, talking about high-tech visas, just that technology companies rely on this sort of, you know, foreign labor a lot. Many people don't realize that there's also kind of this never-ending global scramble for low-skilled labor that goes on in industries like farming, like meatpacking and poultry, like warehouse work even. And, you know, you can go back as far as you want in the origins of America and find that we've always had this global scramble of low-wage work. And so I think one of the points that the caller was kind of making is that there's some sort of necessity in the American economy for these kind of workers. And what are the Trump administration doing about it?
It's a good place to end our conversation. Michael Graybell, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and congratulations on your article.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for ProPublica, and the article is titled Sold for Parts. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of the show. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nouri. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.